Libya was removed from the UN's list of children's rights violators after Riyadh threatened to cut off crucial funding to the world body. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions, resulting in what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The coalition, which is logistically and militarily supported by the West, especially the US and the UK, has repeatedly bombed schools, hospitals, and other civilian facilities during its seven-year onslaught. The United Nations has in the past been criticized for its inaction against Riyadh, but the latest move by the Human Rights Council seems like giving a green light to Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies to continue their atrocities against impoverished Yemen with impunity.
From the yellow vests to the longest general strike the country has ever seen, France under President Emmanuel Macron has been the site of constant grassroots expression, but also shocking political repression. For the first time since the coronavirus epidemic began, France's unions called a nationwide strike, with protests taking place in over 200 cities and towns. Unions and workers are accusing politicians and bosses of manipulating the corona crisis in order to ram through more far-right economic austerity measures. Deeply unpopular cuts to unemployment insurance take effect this week, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty.
The government has used a pretext of health concerns, cut wages, to cut government jobs, to reduce worker rights, and to allow bad working conditions to get even worse. It's great to see everyone from workers to students to pensioners back in the streets again, because these cuts to unemployment are unacceptable during these tough times.
A decade of failed austerity, followed by the unprecedented corona recession, has given France's lower and middle classes a list of problems too long to fully mention. Inflation, energy prices, intense corona-related restrictions on personal freedom, unemployment, soaring inequality. But perhaps most telling is that even conservative politicians now talk of the need to, quote, make work pay, because French wages and salaries have been so stagnant for so long.
La vie a augmenté à tous les niveaux.
The cost of living does nothing but increase, and in seemingly every possible way. Costs are even higher than when the yellow vests first began, but we haven't been allowed to demonstrate. Until salaries are increased, things will continue to be more and more difficult for the French.
Protesters say that the coronavirus lockdowns and work cutbacks are too often presented as some sort of welcome and generously subsidized vacation. The reality is they have been catastrophic for many average households. The French street is alive with protest for the first time in over 1.5 years, and it may decide the outcome of Macron's re-election bid this April. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
We had become well used to hearing Donald Trump being slated in the European Parliament during debates, but perhaps didn't expect that his successor, Joe Biden, would also attract scathing criticism.
He did not consult us when he withdrew from Afghanistan. He completely sidelined us in the AUKUS deal.
AUKUS relates to a new military pact between Canberra, London and Washington. It means a deal involving France building submarines for Australia has been scrapped. This has created big tensions between the EU and the US. The reaction from European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to the tensions has not gone down well.
We have a Commission President who recently proclaimed her empire, stating European military forces would be part of the solution. When will the EU recognize it is part of the problem, not the solution?
Some legislators say the EU can no longer talk about values while at the same time cowering to America.
This is a country which is ruthlessly pursuing an espionage case against Julian Assange for publishing information about US war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq, including attempts to kidnap and kill him.
Many members of the European Parliament claim the Donald Trump era proves that EU leaders will never stand up to the United States.
For example, what did they do when Trump tried to start trade wars? took the US out of the Paris Climate Agreement, withdrew funding for Palestinian refugees and supported Israel's illegal occupation program? And what about his rubbishing of the World Health Organization amid a global pandemic?
Lawmakers say revelations that the US continues to spy on top EU politicians, officials and institutions has also eroded trust. Experts agree.
It is absolutely central to explore ways in which trust could be re-established across the Atlantic. Trust not only between governments, but also private sector and individuals who are very much concerned about, you know, how their data and their information is used.
Members of the European Parliament, MEPs, say Biden's failure to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal, despite indicating he would, also illustrates how the United States cannot be trusted. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The hunger strike of six Palestinian prisoners who have refused to eat for days have once again brought the plight of Palestinian prisoners to attention. The six are on hunger strike to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them.
Israeli prison authorities refused to deal with the hunger strikers' legal demands. Kayed Al-Fosfos has been on a hunger strike for over 82 days. Mehdad Al-Ghawasmi for over 76 days, and both were transferred to Goplan Hospital. Ala Al-Araj as well has been transferred to Al-Ramlis Clinic. Their health condition is deteriorating, but they insist to continue with their move to end their illegal detention.
In solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah. Here, every week, you'll see prisoners' mothers and wives holding the pictures of their beloved ones. They say they are the voice of the prisoners.
My son Mojahed went on a hunger strike and ended it after the Israeli authorities decided not to renew his administrative detention and to release him. Mojahed spent almost 10 years in jail, and then he was rearrested after 15 months of release. His administrative detention has been renewed three times. That's why he started the open-ended hunger strike. I know he was risking his life, but that was only for the hope that he could be released to live with us, his family, and to raise his only child.
Administrative detention is illegal, however. It's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, where 520 of them under the illegal administrative detention.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoner follows the same path in the future. Unfortunately, Israel ends the administrative detention only when hunger-striking prisoners are on the verge of death. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Tensions between China and Taiwan have once again escalated after Taipei reported that 148 Chinese fighter jets flied over the island's air defense zone since Friday. That was a day Beijing marked the founding of the People's Republic of China with a military parade. Taiwanese government officials said they have to be on alert for China's, quote, military activities, while Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen said the island would do what it took to defend itself. This is China regards a self-ruled island a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. However, Taiwan says it's an independent country and seeks help from the West, especially the United States, to boost its defense. Currently, the U.S. is Taiwan's largest weapons supplier, despite having no formal ties with the island. On Monday, China once again lashed out at the U.S. for selling arms to Taiwan and sending its warship to the Taiwan Strait. The Foreign Ministry described Washington's actions as provocative and irresponsible and urged it to stop bolstering Taiwanese separatist forces. Some experts believe the U.S. is hatching plots to further push Taiwan into secession from China.
The U.S. is trying to push the envelope as far as possible, trying all kinds of tactics and measures to push Taiwan forward as if it was a separate country without declaring its former status as a separate country.
The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. Last week, London sent a warship through the Taiwan Strait for the first time since 2008. That, despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over such moves. For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. But ties between Beijing and Washington deteriorated sharply under former President Donald Trump. China had hoped for an improved relation under Trump's successor, but since taking office, Joe Biden has maintained pressure on China, showing no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies. Biden is even seeking new alliances to counter China's rising influence in the region and beyond.
This is a crisis that was said to have blown over. It was supposed to be a gradual return to full fuel tanks and drivers reassured that the very worst was behind them. Those in England's southeast continue to be hit especially hard. And despite army personnel now helping with the distribution of fuel to forecourts most in need, Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng denied the UK was at crisis point.
The last few days have been difficult. We've seen large queues. But I think the situation is stabilizing. We're getting petrol into the forecourts.
For consumers, the minister's words may well ring hollow.
I just think it's embarrassing that, again, we live in the UK, that we have to get the army to drive trucks. So, yeah, ridiculous. I think it's what we just get used to now, isn't it? I mean, that's just how it is. This government's terrible. Preceding governments have been just as bad. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah, this shouldn't be happening in the UK today.
You should bring in foreign help. I mean, workers from abroad who actually know how to drive lorries and to carry the fuel to the pumping stations.
UK is a very big country and very rich country and a developed country. All this mess should not be like in your life since day one. So I really don't understand all this mess, really.
It should have been business as usual at these pumps, but for many drivers, they'll be wondering whether or not their reality is being matched by the rhetoric coming out of Downing Street, and worse still, if this is a shape of things to come.
The government's had to admit that one of the solutions touted to alleviate the crisis, relaxing the visa rules for experienced EU HGV drivers, has underperformed.
What we said to the road haulage industry was, fine, give us the names of the drivers that you want to bring in and we'll sort out the visas. We got another 5,000 visas. They only produced 127 names.
The worry is that this fuel issue becomes a crisis of confidence in Britain's ability to deliver the basics for its citizens. This might leave more of a damaging legacy than the government cares to admit. Amina Taylor, London.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
TD, good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
the spotlight.
Beijing has urged Washington to halt military ties with Taiwan. This is in response to reports that U.S. Marines have been on the island for more than a year to train Taiwanese forces. China has stressed it'll do anything to protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Beijing says that the island of 24 million people is part of its territory, threatening to take its control by force if Taipei announces independence. Now, this summit news that a U.S. nuclear-powered Navy submarine has collided with an object in the South China Sea. And this has prompted some Chinese to take to social media and ask the government to strike back and liberate Taiwan immediately. Now let's go to Wyatt Reed in Washington, D.C. Wyatt, good to have you with us. Tell us how the U.S. media reacted to the news of this collision of the U.S. nuclear-powered Navy submarine and the high stakes of the South China Sea.
That's right. U.S. media reports have largely focused on the unintentionality of this incident, emphasizing that it did not strike another submarine. Unclear exactly what was struck right now. What we do know is that this revelation that the U.S. troops have been training Taiwanese forces for over a year now is also something that we had indications of previously. Last November, in fact, the Taiwanese military more or less bragged that this was the case, as prompting the U.S. military to describe those reports as infactual, right? Or rather, inaccurate, I should say. We now know that it was not the case, that the U.S. military was effectively lying when it denied those reports. They have essentially been confirmed, or rather, you know, confirmation by lack of rejection at this point. So we know that this is some type of action that is going to increase the stakes in the Taiwanese Strait. It's certainly provocative for any military to be providing military aid to secessionists, which claim to have territorial control, you know, aspirations over the entirety of mainland China. Certainly not conducive to good relations between the U.S. and China.
All right, thanks for that. Wyatt Reed in Washington, D.C. Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrou Sanjif. We will be discussing China-U.S. issue over Taiwan today. Let me introduce our guests in this edition. Well, an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin, Frank Inspeck from Madison. And also author with NT Conquista, Nicholas Ayala, joining us out of Newark.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, now let me just welcome our guests to the show, both, and let's go to Frank in Madison. Now, Frank, there are some people who are arguing that Washington's confirmation that U.S. Marines training Taiwanese forces for more than a year could undermine moves toward détente between Washington and Beijing. Do you share the same view?
Well, certainly. I mean, first of all, it was done in secret. And so, at the one hand, you're saying you want to have good relations and criticizing the Chinese for flying planes too close to Taiwan. On the other hand, you've got a secret military operation going on. So, obviously, it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nicholas, let us know your opinion on that.
I agree entirely. I mean,
if detente is still defined as wanting to ease relations between hostile nations, then of course this is going to do the exact opposite. The Taiwanese government is one that seeks to claim territory, claim sovereignty over all of mainland China, which is absolutely ridiculous, and has been a point of tension for decades between U.S. and Chinese relationships and their history. So I think this move by the U.S. military is clearly an undermining of Chinese interests and Chinese wishes, as well as previous agreements that the U.S. and China have agreed upon to essentially not recognize the sovereignty of the Taiwanese government.
Mm-hmm. Now, Frank, the U.S. is aware of how sensitive the Taiwan issue is for China. So what do you think is behind Washington's provocations in Taiwan?
Well, I'm not sure what's behind it. There has been since 1949, since the Civil War in China, a very, very strong lobby, initially in the 50s and 60s, who lost China like it's ours to lose, but consistent for many, many years now, basically never really wanting to recognize the sovereignty of the Chinese government. And China, of course, has been very clear that there's going to be a one-China policy, and that's the only thing they're willing to accept. Now, we agreed to do that, which is why we have the current arrangements we do. But clearly, there is unrest within the administration over that, and the Taiwanese issue may be a good way to show that the Biden administration is really strong and a strong military, you know, and can stand up to threats and so forth, because I think he's looking for various ways to mobilize people behind the administration that are not going to be mobilized because of the economic issues that he's pushing.
Now, Nicholas, in reaction to the U.S. troop deployment in Taiwan, China has said that it will take all necessary steps to protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity. So what message is Beijing sending to the U.S., NATO, and Taiwan?
Well, Beijing's sending a hardline message, and it usually sends these messages of, look, we have this policy, we've all agreed upon this policy, that is the one China policy, and it's in everyone's interest, because I would also argue it's in the interest of the U.S. economically, who's become so economically interconnected to the Chinese economy. It's in the world's interest to not heighten tensions between the U.S. and China, between two of the largest global economic powers in the world, and not to rush into any sort of irrational decisions that could lead to hostile acts. And China is really trying to remind, I would say, the world that there are agreements that were set, where you know the international world kind of came together and concurred, and those agreements are not being met right now. They're being undermined, and China's not going to stand for that. It's gotten to a point where China can now actually assert itself on the international world because of its growth economically, politically, and militarily. So it's going to use that newfound strength to really push its own interests against the interests of NATO and the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Frank, the U.S. and Taiwan are believed to be exaggerating this Chinese military flights in that area. Taipei claims as its Air Defense Identification Zone, ADIZ. You know, it's not a country's airspace, and the Chinese warplanes typically pass through the southwestern corner of that area, far from Taiwan. So what's the reason for this hype?
I think to make the point that the prior speaker made, that the Chinese intend to assert themselves. You know, one, you're looking at Taiwan, but you might want to look at South America, because what's happening there is the Chinese are making huge investments in an area that's been traditionally controlled by the United States. And if we're talking about challenges, that's an example of the Chinese growth economically and politically. And I suspect that there is more and more interest in this in Washington than meets the eye. But the fact of the matter is that China is the number two economic power today. There's every expectation that it will go back to where it was in the 17th century, that it's the number one economic power and the number one technological power. And, you know, the United States is having trouble understanding that and accepting that. So I think all of that is also within this context of we may no longer be number one and maybe number two, and it's very, very hard for any administration or the population here to accept that idea.
Nicholas, on Tuesday we had U.S. President Biden telling reporters that he and President Xi Jinping have agreed to stick with the Taiwan agreement. Well, this has many wonder if Washington and Beijing have reached an agreement on Taiwan's political status. What's your assessment?
Well, it's interesting when you read the reports about that meeting. As you said, Biden agreed with Xi Jinping to continue to follow the Taiwan agreement. But at the same time, after he made that statement, Taiwan officials reached out to Biden asking for clarification on what he meant, and the U.S. responded saying that relationships between the U.S. and Taiwan will continue as they've always have been. So in other words, what the U.S. is doing and what the U.S. has historically done is it speaks out of both sides of its mouth. It's going to reassure China that they're going to continue their policies because the U.S. doesn't want any serious conflict with China because it can't afford to. And at the same time, it's going to reassure Taiwan that, look, we're going to continue our relationship that we've historically had with you, and kind of sort of subtly undermining the Taiwan agreement. Now, the U.S. does that because the U.S. sees Taiwan as strategically located in a position where they can assert their own dominance to counter Chinese dominance. And that's really what we're seeing when the U.S. speaks out of both sides of its mouth. It tries to reassure Xi Jinping while simultaneously trying to reassure the Taiwanese.
Now, Frank, there are some analysts who expect a spiral of military tension in the region, given the circumstance that many consider to be the crux of Beijing's One China principle. Do you expect a war?
Well, I don't expect that, and I certainly hope that there won't be one, because then we're not going to have to worry about climate change or anything else. The fact of the matter is, it's not in our interest to have a war in the United States' interest or the Chinese over Taiwan or over anything else, because you've got humanity at stake here. Mm-hmm. And I think that the parties understand that. The danger here is that you could begin to do things that escalate and that go beyond somebody's control. Or you could have the election of a leader in some country, say this one, that is irrational. And so all these rational ideas don't make any sense. I think that the danger here is that there is no vision. At least I don't see a vision here in the United States that says we need to reset our relationship and figure out how we can actually have a progressive, positive, open relationship with China. What would that look like? Would it be the same thing as building submarines, or maybe we're going to build something else like that we can mutually trade? And I don't hear that vision. I don't hear that speaking. I don't hear that coming from the administration or any significant sector of the people who make foreign policy in this country. And that is extremely concerning to me.
Now, Nicholas, we have the Taiwanese defense minister who's saying that this recent Chinese warplane drills has put the military tensions across the Taiwan Strait at their most serious level in more than four decades. And then he predicted that China could attack Taiwan within the next 4 years. Would China do that?
Well, as previously stated, I think, you know, attacking Taiwan would be irrational on China's part. There's no reason for China to attack a territory that they already claim to have domain over. There's no reason for them to risk their economic, military, and political power, which is on the rise, trying to go to war with the Western countries over Taiwan. It would just be absolutely irrational for the Chinese to launch some sort of invasion against Taiwan. But the Taiwanese defense minister is saying all of this because it is in the Taiwanese interest to push this propaganda of a potential war looming on the horizon, a potential Chinese invasion, because that's really what gets spread in the U.S. Media and told to the U.S. The population in order to justify continuous military actions with Taiwan or in the South China Sea in order to defend Taiwanese interests, which really don't need to be defended.
Frank, what about in case Taipei announces independence from China?
Well, that's a whole other question, and I don't know. I think the Chinese would probably feel pretty upset about that. Then the question is, who would recognize the independence? Taiwan can say anything it wants, but if Japan and the United States and the other major powers continue to uphold the China agreement and don't recognize Taiwan, then I don't suppose much will happen. But obviously, if they declared independence and gave up the aspiration of reconquering China, which of course is completely nuts, and then somebody of significance recognized them, that would be a major shift in the wrong direction, I suspect, and certainly ratchet up tensions and bring about maybe the possibility of an armed confrontation. Although since everybody knows this is what would happen, it's not. I'm hopeful that rationality will prevail here, particularly amongst the Western powers, so-called. Taiwan will not declare independence, I suspect, unless they have a already an agreement with somebody of significance to recognize them. What would be the point?
Nicholas, let's hear your opinion.
No, I mean, I agree entirely. It would make no sense, even from a Taiwan perspective, to declare independence without recognition. And this is sort of the struggle that we're seeing play out right now. And we've seen that through the struggle that most countries are unwilling to really recognize Taiwan as a nation state, because that would cause serious conflict and serious issues with the PRC government, which is significantly stronger, has a significantly larger role and impact in the global economy, and is far more invested in the international community's interests, both economically, politically, and militarily. So it really doesn't make much sense for Taiwan even to declare independence and sort of push without having the other major nations support them. They would simply be pushing the whole world into a serious conflict, into a potential armed conflict.
Frank, the State Department has asserted the U.S. commitment to Taiwan as rock solid. Now the question is, why should there be such a strong commitment and even legislation in the United States to give such a strong support to another country?
Well, this is from the Civil War in the 1940s. You know, the question was posed in this country, and it was a source of McCarthy's support. Senator McCarthy went after people saying, who lost China? This was a big thing. That there were people in the State Department who conspired with the communists in China to lose China. In other words, for Chiang Kai-shek, who was the dictator and thrown out, to lose. And there was this very, very large lobby of conservative Republicans primarily, but also some Democrats, who for years persisted in this who lost China business. President Nixon, when he lost the first time to Kennedy by just a sliver, his campaign was defending Quemoy and Matsu, you know, these two islands off Taiwan, you know, within shouting distance to China. So this issue of China has been a part of American foreign policy for years. Part of the justification for the war in Vietnam was China, that they were an aggressor, that really North Vietnam was a tool of China. Not true, obviously, but still, that's part of the popular culture. That's part of a deep, deep strain in the Republican Party. The Cheneys, in spite of what problems he's having now, the Cheney faction in the Republican Party believe this. So, you know, the you cannot separate this long-standing anti-communist aspect of American foreign policy, particularly in regards to China, from what's happening today. And again, from Biden or other people saying, maybe we can use this to bolster our credentials as being tough. I mean, we had a rough time in Afghanistan, but now we can stand up and show we're tough in the way that the Pentagon likes, with bombers and ships and whatnot.
Right. Nicholas, China is also opposed to the AUKUS deal by the U.S., the UK and Australia, as you know. So where do Australia and the UK stand in this U.S.-China dispute?
Well, seemingly from the AUKUS deal, Australia and the UK are right alongside with the United States. And it's interesting, you know, the deal which involves the nuclear power submarines essentially is coming out of these three nations who are very interested in the strategic region of the South China Sea. And it's very clear that this is what the deal is all about, even though there's no mention of China and even though there's no mention of any particular regions. It's obvious that given the previous very recent events that have unfolded with crises in the South China Sea, with multiple nations claiming ownership of certain islands and certain resources, it's clear that the U.S., Australia, and the U.K. are working together to have some sort of influence in this region. They see that there are, you know, large reserves of oil, natural gas in the area, and they want to really reinforce like I said earlier, assert their dominance in the region. And this is all being coupled with, as again mentioned before, the rise of China. So China's being able to extend their own influence throughout the Pacific, and this is becoming a threat because the Pacific is one of the most important international trade avenues or trade routes for many nations, especially in the United States and especially Australia. So they need to be able to have their own trade routes protected, have their own hegemony protected, and this is really what the deal is showing. The deal is showing that the U.S., U.K., and Australia are on one side, and they're putting China and potentially many other allies like Russia and Iran on the other side.
Okay. Frank, we only have 30, 40 seconds. Tell us about the U.K. and this. We had a British ship also sailing in disputed waters near China recently.
Say that again, please.
Tell us about the U.K. and where the U.K. stands in this.
Well, you know, the U.K., you mean Great Britain, or maybe Mini Britain, they're still back with, taking Hong Kong and the wars in 1825. They haven't quite got the picture yet, Boris Johnson in particular. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they want to be a partner, and they're basically a very, very junior partner, more like a lapdog than a partner, but that's what they're after. And the conservative government has been very clear that they want to be considered as a leader here. And from a practical point of view, it's nonsense. From a political point of view, they're trying to distinguish themselves a bit from the European Union. But I think overall, the question really is the United States going to reassess what it's doing? Are there forces here that are going to say going down the road of confrontation, of economic warfare, is not in our interests as a nation or as a world? And are they strong enough, or they will be strong enough, to do something about it?
Okay.
Because if not, and we have this continuing tension, sooner or later, something disastrous will happen.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this episode. So let me thank our guest, Red Emeritus Professor with the University of Wisconsin, Frank Ensbeck from Madison, and author of the Anti-Conquista, Nicholas Ayala-In. Job and your host, Behrouz Najafian. I'll see you next time.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Claire Mosley, the founder of Care for Calais, said, "Targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. UK government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities rather than putting them in places like Napier barracks or large hotels." We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Diane Taylor and Mark Townsend. The piece is titled "UK Home Office Records 70 Racist Incidents by Far Right at Asylum Accommodation." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a Freedom of Information response obtained by The Guardian, the UK Home Office has recorded 70 racist incidents by far-right supporters against asylum seekers in barracks and hotel accommodation. However, campaigners supporting asylum seekers in such accommodation say the figure is a significant underestimation of the true picture. The data, which covers 1st of January 2020 until 13th of July this year, involves incidents in the much maligned Napier and Penally barracks, which have been under intense scrutiny by MPs after their untenable conditions were revealed, as well as a large-scale COVID outbreak in the former. Penally barracks in Pembrokeshire, Wales was closed in March, despite only being opened in September of 2020, along with Napier in Folkestone, Kent. Hotels have been used throughout the period, but their use for asylum seekers increased sharply after the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020. In Napier barracks, four incidents were recorded between September and December of 2020, with 12 occurring so far this year. This is despite the barracks being temporarily emptied in April after the coronavirus outbreak. There are now thought to be 176 asylum seekers living there. Several incidents at Penally Barracks was reported to the Home Office last year, and many in 2021. Witness statements from legal challengers by asylum seekers living there reveal a catalogue of disturbing episodes, including an attempt to ram a refugee with a car. Others include stones and bottles being thrown, rape threats, attempts to start fights, fireworks shot through the gate, and eggings. According to witness statements, a farm shop in the area said some of the far-right supporters had asked to buy pigeon scarers to mimic the sound of gunfire and frighten asylum seekers. The number of incidents recorded in hotels has tripled this year, with 40 examples reported, up from 13 last year. On Saturday, 7th of August, the far-right organisation Britain First posted a video on its website headlined "Britain First Exposes an Illegal Immigrant Hotel in Hull," in which members of the organisation say they posed as journalists to confront asylum seekers. One asylum seeker from Yemen experienced two incidents involving far-right protesters at his Home Office-provided hotel on the outskirts of London. He said, "They were driving around the hotel recording us on video," adding, "They were insulting us, swearing at us, and screaming things like, 'Go out from our country. Why are you eating our food? Go away from us. You are strangers here.' We were too scared to go outside the hotel and felt like it was a prison. We had to stay inside." He added, "We fled countries where there is war and destruction and felt safe when we arrived here. But when we saw this kind of racist attack, we felt we were not protected." Maddie Harris of Humans for Rights Network said, "Ghettoizing people seeking safety in large-scale accommodations such as hotels and army barracks exposes them to harm. The figures shown here are not an accurate representation of the level of racial abuse endured by the people we support. We have had numerous conversations with asylum seekers where they have told us how unsafe they feel due to frequent incidents of racial abuse and that they have experienced in and around these accommodations." Claire Mosley, the founder of Care for Calais, said, "Targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. Our government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities rather than putting them in places like Napier barracks or large hotels." A Home Office spokesperson said, "It is unacceptable for anyone in asylum accommodation to experience hostile or racist incidents, and we ensure each incident is thoroughly investigated. We work closely with a range of organizations to ensure immediate support and assistance is provided to people living in the accommodation, and if needed, escalate to law enforcement." Meanwhile, European citizens who have applied for settled status are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The Home Office has served European Union nationals with removal directions, even though they could prove they had applied for settled status, which should protect their rights to remain in the United Kingdom. Ministers have repeatedly promised that anyone who had applied by the 30th of June deadline would have their existing rights protected while their case was being heard. The apparent failure to honour the agreement has prompted accusations of either administrative incompetence by the Home Office officials or a willful attempt to deport as many European Union nationals as possible, on the assumption they're easier to remove, for instance, than asylum seekers. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to the head of Immigration Enforcement, dated 29th of July, raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge receipt of settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport European Union citizens. Bail for Immigration Detainees says that unless a meaningful response is received from the Home Office, it will make an official complaint to the European Commission. Lawyers argue it marks an important battle to protect the rights of European Union nationals following Brexit. They warn that the failure to acknowledge applications could potentially affect thousands of individuals. Recently, an EU citizen from the Home Office wanted to deport and who had been detained in an immigration removal centre secured their release on bail after a judge accepted that they could not be removed because they had made an European Union settlement scheme application. Even so, the Home Office still contested their release and offered no apology or explanation why it had earlier argued there was no evidence of the application at a previous hearing and therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the European Union national who requested anonymity told The Observer, "They're trying to play with mine and my family's lives and it's not fair. I'm supposed to have rights." Pierre McClough, legal director of Bail for Immigration Detainees, said, "It seems that the Home Office has pre-decided the fate of certain European Union nationals, perhaps believing that they're easy to remove. But in its drive to deport more people, it is sidestepping legal requirements and legal procedures. The issue appears to relate mostly to applications sent by post instead of being forwarded digitally." Aranea Kogolathos, a barrister and legal manager of BIDS EEA, European Economic Area Project, said, "Paper applications were used by many vulnerable and marginalized people, including the elderly and those in detention or prison, who found it difficult to access computer or didn't have access to a valid identity document. The numbers affected could be significant. For instance, out of 1,500 inmates at Wandsworth Prison in South London, almost 500 are believed to be European Union nationals." Barrister Aranea Kogolathos said, "Despite having made the European Union settlement scheme applications, European Economic Area nationals are being deprived of their liberty and even served with removal directions, both of which they are forced to challenge despite limited access to legal advice and legal representation."
Good morning. morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.